On your course outline, if you happen to notice, there are a couple titles for the lectures, the last one of which is today, the last one of the pair, and the titles are Learning to Learn and Listening. And I will try to bring us up to the end of today, by the end of the hour. I want to point up a few things about the matter of learning to learn. I think it is terribly important, and one of the most direct applications of whatever this course is designed to give you is to be made by learning to learn. Now, one of the most fundamental kinds of considerations in this connection has to do with the relationship between past learning and new learning. If the past learning is compatible with new learning, then the rate of learning tends to be increased with more past learning. The more you learn, the more you learn, provided what you're learning goes with what you've learned. If it doesn't, then the opposite may well be true. If what you are trying to learn now is incompatible with what you've already learned, then there will be some kind of a mathematical function in the direction of the new learning being inhibited by past learning. And if you're going to learn to learn, you must somehow learn to cope with this relationship between what you have already learned and what you have yet to learn. Now, there are some rather obvious observations to be made of this relationship. You need to know a little bit about the learning process, and I assume most of you have had some courses in psychology, or some of you have had, I assume, many, but it may be that because the language used in the psychology of learning is so different from our everyday folk language, it may be that it's a little like trying to learn a foreign language in the middle of Iowa, and you don't have much opportunity to use, for instance, French or Italian here. You don't have much opportunity to use the language of the psychology of learning in most dinner table conversations. It's quite foreign to our folk language, I think. Quite different. As a counselor in the clinic, I have noticed especially some of the things that people hardly ever talk about. Not only what they do talk about, but what they don't talk about turns out to be, I think, significant. And they hardly ever talk about learning. They hardly ever talk about their problems, their difficulties, as though they had learned them. They tend to talk about them either as though they were inborn, they were hereditary, or the result of an illness or an accident. So they have a sharp beginning due to causes that are essentially beyond control of the individual. Or they talk as though they had a fear or a suspicion, anxiety, that maybe they're maladjusted. And this is a rather horrendous word, as it is ordinarily used by people who are not very well informed about abnormal psychology and psychotherapy and so forth. The word neurosis for most people is almost as bad as the word hereditary. It sounds almost as fateful. And these are the kinds of explanations people seem to talk in terms of. This is the folk thinking. But learning, no, almost never does anybody talk about how he learned to have the fears and tensions that he is bothered by. Well, one of the very most important things that I think we have learned, at least we have theorized with regard to learning, the learning process, is that we tend to persist in doing those things which are reinforced. Now, if you have learned something, and what do you learn? There are various things you learn. You learn, for instance, things to do. You learn things to know. And you learn things to feel. You learn knowledge. You learn feelings and attitudes. And you learn skills or motor patterns, patterns of doing. Now, if you've learned any one of these, if you've learned to know something, if you're a child brought up in Birmingham, Alabama, you're a white child brought up in Birmingham, Alabama, you have learned a great deal of knowledge, may or may not be valid, but it's called knowledge, and that is what you have learned it for, about the question having to do with race. You've learned this. It's probably, or it may have been, let's just say if it has been, highly reinforced in all the ways that it would be in a family where everybody agrees about these things. And so when you say, when you've learned to say a certain kind of, to make a certain kind of statement about race, that the white race is superior to the black, for example, and your grandparents and your parents and your uncles and your aunts all smile, and this learning gets heavily reinforced. Now, after it has been sufficiently reinforced by the rewards that it has elicited, and if you have done it frequently, if you have said these things frequently, well, it's going to be quite difficult for you to learn anything different after a while. Past learning here is going to retard new learning to the degree that it has been positively reinforced. Now, if you've learned to play as I have, if you've learned to play ping pong in a certain way, to hold the paddle this way, you know, this way, it's very difficult to learn to hold it this way. Especially if you have won just enough to have fun. So that the way of doing it has been reinforced. And if your friends have done it that way. And so it goes. This is too obvious to labor very much. If your attitudes or your knowledge or your skills have been learned, have been heavily reinforced, then if you are in the future then faced with learning knowledge, attitudes, skills that are different from these well-learned, well-reinforced ones, then of course past learning will tend to retard new learning. If on the other hand you are going on with the same kind of learning that you have been indulging in the past, well, the more reinforcement, the more you've learned, and the more that has been reinforced positively, the more you will tend to learn of the same kind of thing, to get the same kind of reinforcement that you have also learned to work for. It's very difficult to learn anything new. I think we wildly underestimate what this involves. And if you're going to learn, And if you're going to mean by this to learn something different from what you've already learned, and then you have your work very well cut out for you, and it's very difficult. One of the examples that may help to emphasize this as much as I think that it needs to be, is I have been told by pilots that they, in order to learn to fly by instrument, they have to do what feels wrong. I think this is the way with all learning, that is a kind that that changes the course of your development. For a while you got to do something that feels wrong. You got to say things that sound wrong. You got to do things that feel wrong. If this doesn't happen, then the chances are you're going on learning as you have in the past. This may be what you want to do. I'm not necessarily deriding that. It's just that there's a difference involved in doing anything that will change your course. I think you need to, if you're going to be interested in this, if you're at all interested in learning to learn, it's pretty necessary to take stock of what you have learned that you would regard as being significant up to now, and to evaluate the kind of reinforcement that you have received, and to consider whether this is something that you would care to do anything about. Because if you're going to do anything about it, it's going to involve some pain, discomfort, some feelings of uneasiness, anxiety. You're going to go through something like what the pilot goes through when he learns to fly by instrument. It's going to take real courage. I want to add one more thing to this. I've been talking about things you learn that are positively reinforced. You learn to do some things that are avoidant in character because of the negative reinforcement. A stutter is a good example. He learns to not go ahead and talk. He learns to exert effort holding back, at least this is how he feels it, because he has been negatively reinforced by the experience of talking. And in this, he resembles all of us in some way. I mean, everybody, I think, resembles a stutterer in some way, in some degree. Everyone, that is, has experienced negative reinforcement and avoidant learning. You spend part of your energy not doing things. You have learned not to risk certain kinds of behavior. Now, if you're going to learn to do those things, if a stutter is going to learn to talk, he will have to undergo considerable discomfort in learning not to react to the negative reinforcement as he has in the past. If you're going to learn to get over your stage fright or your shyness in talking to important strangers and so on, whatever your avoidant behaviors are, you're going to have to change the way you have responded to the negative reinforcement that you have learned to expect. Now, let's have the next slide. And I'm going to try to make some kind of generalizations about this. And again, we need some kind of terms to define a continuum that we can talk about as objectively as possible. There are modes of behavior, and we need some kind of names for them. It'd be nice if we could number them, perhaps, or just use letters, A and B, so as to avoid, so far as possible, any kind of evaluations that might be offensive. But we do want to become acquainted with some contrasts, with some distinctions. And there is some way that we can do this in terms we've used before, but I want to make some more remarks about them. Probably most of us, since we've grown up in the kind of culture we have, tend to exhibit, perform, considerably more in terms of what we might talk about as a magical orientation, rather than a scientific one. After all, the scientific kind of orientation is fairly recent, historically, in its more highly developed forms. And most of us, admittedly, have not been exposed to environments where we would be expected to learn the kinds of things that people do, the kinds of things they say, the sorts of things they believe, the kinds of attitudes they have in a highly scientific environment. We haven't been in those environments, and it would be most unreasonable to expect us to have learned those things. We have been much more, I think most of us, I assume most people in our culture have been more in environments in which there's a good deal of belief in magical transformation of one kind or another, not very much emphasis upon something like the learning process and the variables related to this and the careful assessment of these variables, and so on. This isn't the way we usually approach problems. We're much more likely to think of our problems, as I indicated a while ago, as having been more or less suddenly caused all at once, some accident or some unplanned sort of circumstance for which we have had no responsibility. We feel as though we're the victims of fate, or we've had bad luck, misfortune. These are common words. And we tend to react by trying to find the healer, the knower, the magician in some form. And I'm using the word magician here as a technical term. In some form, it can be a teacher or a parent or old Judge Brown or whoever. But it's someone, the doctor, who's supposed to know, and so we tend to solve our problems magically, or attempt to, that is. That is, by obtaining the right kind of a potion, pill, or treatment, having the right word said at the right time, under the right circumstances, and so on. Now, this is what most of us have learned because of the accident of birth and geography. So, let's have the next slide. If we're going to learn anything different, that is, if we're going to learn and not just keep on learning what we're used to learning, if we're going to learn that so that we do it consciously. But if we're going to learn in any way different from that, then we're going to have to become aware of what the difference is. And we've talked about this before, and again, I merely want to point up a few things just to remind us that there are differences here in the kinds of assumptions, in the degree of awareness we have of the symbolic functions involved in our behavior and their relationship to what we do, the relation of our language, that is, the structure of our language to what we call our thought, the relation of these things to what we do, the specific difference between the kind of language which we can describe in almost slangy way by calling it the is and have language versus a do language. Most of us have learned to repeat such statements as, it's more important what you are than what you do. And if you're going to learn anything different from that, it helps a good deal to know what this different kind of thing is you might be learning. It's more important what you do, and it's really a little difficult to say what you are aside from what you do. This is another kind of orientation. Now, you may not want to call it scientific. You may not want to call the other one by the name of magical. It doesn't much matter what you call them, but there are obvious contrasts here. There is a difference in the level of awareness of one's reasons for doing what one does, motivation, awareness, as against a kind of impulsiveness or compulsion or acting out of what seems like instinct or intuition or just sort of, in general, rather unexamined motivations. And much of this can be summed up in the pair of terms at the bottom, the lack of awareness of abstracting as a function that we perform, as against a consciousness of this abstracting process, what is involved in it, and what can go wrong with it, and how it can be done well or poorly, etc., and the variables related to it. Let's have the next slide, please. Now, yeah. No, there was another one in there. Is there one missing? Did you? There is. How many you got?
I have three left, and they are listening.
Oh, you don't. You have used all the others you have. You just have three left. Okay, all right.
Go ahead with it. I mean, that's an excellent. What I was going to show you is, I wanted to emphasize something. Huh? You got it?
This one? I have the sign.
There it is.
I think we underestimate wildly the difficulty in making any significant change in our learning, in reversing or in any significant way altering the course of learning on which we have already been launched. For a very important reason, and that is that we are engaged in what we are doing and believing and in exercising the skills we have learned and the attitudes we've acquired. We're engaged in this not alone, but with others who reinforce by their reactions, by their approvals, what we're doing. Our families, our close associates, our friends, often our teachers and other authority figures. And in order to make any very significant change, it is sometimes necessary to undergo very great disruption in one's personal relationships. And this is not to be lightly entered upon. I think you would want to consider a long while before you launch into some kind of very vigorous effort to change the course of your development up to date. I think you need to be very thoughtful about it and realize what you are doing in these terms that are so simply represented by this crude diagram. You're going to trade the most important friends you have for other friends that you don't have yet. You're going to, in some cases, leave home. And while you may go back physically, you'll never go back again quite otherwise. This may not at all be good. You may not be able to stand it. And there may be other kinds of consequences that you would not want to risk. I think it would be highly irresponsible of anyone to advocate that you just go ahead and be different from the way you are. I think you need to be highly aware of who's going to be affected by this, in what ways, and how will this affect you in turn. This is an interaction. This is a can of worms again. It's very complicated. And it is one way to be selfish is to give it no thought. Now let's have the next one. Learning to learn is in very large part a matter of learning to abstract, as we have been talking about this all semester. Learning to observe as well as you can what stares you in the face. Learning to ask questions that may be embarrassing, that may be very challenging, may be threatening, and learning to ask them very clearly so that observations can be made with which to answer them. Making the observations, this is how you learn. This is learning to learn. This is the how of learning. And learning to test what you have previously concluded against these new observations that you make now and that others have made that you now become acquainted with in your quest for the information you need to answer the questions that you have taken the trouble to ask. Well, out of all of these things that we do in learning, in learning to learn in this way, I think the one that we can do most about and that probably is of the greatest importance in most situations for most of us most of the time is listening. Listening is so interestingly overlooked in the schools. Almost nobody pays much attention to listening in any systematic way. Now, it's interesting to wonder why this is. Is it because listening is not important enough to command our attention? Is it because it is too difficult to do anything about? Can't teach it anyway? Is it because everybody knows how to listen? There's nothing to teach. There's no room for improvement. It'd be a waste of time to do anything about it. Well, I think all of these questions merely really serve to deepen the mystery. Why don't we do anything about listening? Well, what is there to do? In the time we have left, we can hit some high spots. There's a good deal to know about what is the matter with the way we listen. One can do a diagnostic job on this, too, you know. And the things I've listed here are just a meager sampling of the kinds of things that we could talk about. And there needs to be a great deal more investigation of this behavior than we've had up to now. But we've had some. I think it's pretty obvious that one of the things we do that keeps us from listening any better than we do is that we pay so much attention to who is speaking, to his symbols of authority or lack of them. If I were giving this on December 7, I would say that in our country, there is, as you all know, a holiday on that day which commemorates Pearl Harbor. Well, to me, as a semanticist, what is interesting about it is that the story of the lieutenant who answered the phone and a private was talking and he said that he saw blips on the radar screen. And the lieutenant told him to forget it. I don't think he would have done that had the fellow on the other end of the phone been a general. We tend to pay too much attention to who is speaking. It is quite obvious, I think, that you could have the same lecture delivered by two people, give them different titles. You know, I don't need to finish the paragraph. You would react differently, depending on the kind of introduction and whether the speaker wore a tuxedo or a uniform of some kind or old dirty overalls. It would make a difference. We tend to pay too much attention to the speaker. A good listener is one who has learned he can't afford to do that. And he pays attention to the message. He pays just as much attention to something that is written with a lead pencil on the back of a laundry slip as he does to a four-color ad on slick paper. Maybe more, under certain circumstances. We tend to listen defensively. This is, again, the effect of previous learning on new learning. Most of us have learned. We've been positively reinforced for refusing to listen to someone who says things that sound disagreeable to us, or at least for refusing to listen well. It is even officially correct behavior for a representative of a government to walk out of a meeting in which his government is being criticized in certain ways. I saw in the paper the other day that one of our ambassadors walked out of a banquet, I believe, in Yugoslavia the other night because of something that one of the Yugoslavs said. This is etiquette, official etiquette. Not to listen to something that is sufficiently disagreeable. Well, whatever else there may be to say about that, and there is much to say about it, of course. It's not very good listening There are some people who wear hearing aids who actually turn them off at certain times when speakers begin to say things that they don't like. Well, this is not good listening. Now, it may be something else that you would admire. I don't know. All sorts of possibilities of evaluation and behavior. But if you're interested in developing good listening, then you keep the channels open, no matter what's coming in. You listen. You listen as well as you can, very effectively. And you don't try to defend yourself against it by thinking up all the reasons why this should not be listened to or why it should be refuted. If you are modeling after the most effective listeners we have, who appear to be the clinicians who listen for a living, some social workers, occasional judges and lawyers, people who whose business it is to listen from 8 to 5, as it were, get good at it sometimes. And people like that don't turn off their hearing aids. They don't refuse to listen. They don't listen to refute. They listen to understand. And when they get done doing this the best they can, they may not accept what they hear for themselves necessarily, but they're likely to understand pretty well why the other person said it. We necessarily translate as we listen to another's speaker. As we've noted before, there's nothing that passes between me and you but air vibrations. No words. You brought the words with you. You're using them now. They're your words. All I'm doing is, by remote control, as it were, tickling a little tiny piece of modified skin at the down at the bottom of your external auditory canal. And you take it from there. I have nothing to do with it once it gets past that piece of modified skin. You supply the words. You're necessarily translating what I say. You simply do not have the attention span, the memory span, to reproduce word for word what I have said since the beginning of the hour. You couldn't possibly. If I were to stop you right now and ask you, what did I just say? Put it down. Go ahead, write it down. What did I just say? Put it on a piece of paper you can tear off and hand in, will you please? What did I just say? You don't know what I just said, put that down. Don't know. Please hand them in to Joan. It will be a miracle if they're all alike. You're supplying the words, is the point I'm trying to make. You translate. You necessarily do this. You can't possibly perform like a tape recorder, give back what I'm saying. So you will tell yourself what I said, but you will use your words to do that. Now you can translate so very thoroughly that you will go out, not only today, but at the end of the course, saying exactly what you did when you came in. It's very, very difficult, in fact, to go out of any lecture or of any course in a university saying anything very different from what you said when you started. I think we tremendously overestimate the possibility of that kind of modification. Now, we could learn, I think, to listen with minimal translation. And this would be one of the objectives of listening training. Now, let's have the next slide. We have just time to review very fast what it is that a good listener seems to do, what a good learner, a person who has learned to learn, tends to listen much more, not just in class, but at the dinner table and at Joe's place and wherever he may be. It is most interesting to observe conversations once you have become interested in listening behavior. It is really quite incredible how little many people seem to listen. They break in. Very often you'll hear conversations in which two or three people are talking at once. This is not uncommon. Just nobody's listening. They probably are not even hearing themselves very well. There must be a little distraction in this situation. A good listener, and you'll likely find him in a clinic, is leaning back as a rule. If he's leaning forward, it's in interest, not in aggressiveness. He's relaxed in any case, probably. Not awfully relaxed, but he's not tense. Noticeably, he's listening, he's taking in, he's receptive. He's listening with a kind of attitude toward what he's hearing, that he is permitting it to come. He's encouraging the other person to say whatever he wants to say. He is permissive in his attitude. Most teachers and parents are not good listeners because they're too much interested in bringing up the child or the student, teaching the student. And very often, the teacher, of course, tells the student when he said something that he shouldn't have said it because he's mistaken. The clinician never does this. I mean, not in the same way a teacher does. A parent will often say to a child, "Don't ever say that to me again." Well, a good clinician would never say a thing like this. A good listener, the main test of a good listener is that he keeps the other person talking. And that isn't the way to keep a person talking. Tell him, "Don't ever say that again." Or to point out what he has said wrong. It just doesn't keep people talking. And any observer of the American educational system would easily observe that there's much more talking in the early grades than in the later grades. There is a reduction in the amount of spontaneity. Teachers are not good listeners. They don't keep pupils talking. Now, maybe there is some question about how much a pupil should talk in a classroom situation, but at least if you want to encourage discussion and free, spontaneous, honest discussion, then you will listen permissively enough to do that. And permit anything to be said that the child feels is important enough to say. And you will listen to what is not said, to all the things that form the context of what is said, the tone of voice and the timing and the postures and the tensions and so on. Let's have the last slide. Learning to learn is largely questioning behavior. That is, learning to learn is largely learning to do what we call questioning very effectively. And it consists in large part in knowing what to ask. And in any kind of a situation where you're trying to cope with problems, as in a clinic, but not just in a clinic, as we have been emphasizing all along, this behavior that we see in clinics can be indulged in anywhere. The questions are those which call for clarification, validation, and the development of implications, and the development of some positive or constructive action. These are the kinds of questions that one learns to ask effectively as one learns to learn. It is by asking questions of this kind in ways that can be answered on the basis of observations one can make that one learns as much as one can. So I want to point up again, if you learn to do this, you must be prepared for the fact that you're going to have to adjust to doing it. And you're going to have to learn to do it so that you are tolerable in society. Because this kind of behavior, the kind of behavior involved in very effective learning, and especially very effective questioning behavior, this tends not to be good manners in ordinary situations, at most dining tables, in most sitting rooms. This is not good manners. You don't go around asking people these kinds of questions in great detail. And you don't give very elaborate answers if anyone should ask you something like this. You become a bore, and you're offensive. Our whole pattern of etiquette takes on a very interesting cast when seen against the reflection of this kind of problem-coping behavior. It's as though, perhaps for good reasons, to reinforce our feelings of security, which we value very highly, we are taught a code of etiquette that tends not to disturb our settled convictions and our established habits. And it is good manners not to suggest to people that they ought to learn in any way different from what they have up to that time. But if